secret little words. So, good evening, Bodhisattvas. So, tonight I want to talk about case 94 of the Blue Cliff Record, the Surangama Sutra's Not Seeing, which is one of the koans on the handout for the talks. Supposedly people don't know, they think it's an 8th century Chinese text. The Chinese text claims that it's a translation from an Indian text, but I believe scholars are not sure, and they think the Chinese might have invented it and just tried to make it look more important by saying that they got it from the Indians, and there were a lot of things like that in Chan. It turns out the Surangama Sutra is about 6 volumes, and I made a go at it, but I certainly didn't get all the way through. Norman Fisher, on a talk on the koan, which I haven't listened to in a long time, but I remember he says that koans always think they can condense things down, so they took a 6 volume sutra and condensed it down to about 4 lines in an attempt to be helpful. And then he reads the sutra and he says, the koan, and says, maybe it wasn't so helpful after all. So here's here's Jones' translation of the sutra, of the koan from the sutra. The Surangama Sutra says, when I don't see, why don't I see the place of my not seeing? If I see the not seeing, then naturally it is not an image that is going unseen. If I do not see the realm of my not seeing, then naturally this is not a something. Why isn't it you? I'll read it again, and we'll read it a few times. But let me just read it one more time because it's so convoluted, and then we'll start talking about it. The Surangama Sutra says, when I don't see, why don't I see the place of my not seeing? If I see the not seeing, then naturally it is not an image that is going unseen. If I do not see the realm of my not seeing, then naturally this is not a something. Why isn't it you? Say what? Aside from how confusing it is, I certainly thought that Zen was all about seeing and getting to see something. And there are even talks where Jones says, don't you want to see it? Let's see it. A long time ago, I went in to work in the room with Daniel Taranio, who's a Roshi in the Pacific Zen lineage up at St. Dot's. And I was trying really hard to present Mu. And I did something, and I don't remember what it was, but I was really trying hard to do it. And Daniel just looked at me and he said, well, Mu isn't something you do, it's something you see. And I think the point there was that I was trying really, really hard to do something, and if I'd actually seen something, maybe it would come out of me more naturally, so I wouldn't be straining so hard to do it. On the other hand, sutras almost always begin, thus I have heard, recounting the words of the Buddha. And kind of echoing that, Yuan Wu, who's the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record, is always saying in the middle of explaining a case, haven't you heard that? Okay. So, Daniel Taranio, haven't you heard? When I don't see, why don't I see the place of my not seeing? That might be useful to say to somebody when they were trying really, really hard to see something. And in that circumstance, maybe it's useful to say, just the way Daniel said, it isn't something you do, it's something to see. Maybe we'll say it isn't something you see. That might be useful. It's worth noting that all of these things are fables or stories or metaphors for what's basically ineffable, so that anything we can say about it will be one version that brings certain things forward and leaves other things dark. And it's worth remembering that the great American poet Wallace Stevens talks about the lunatic of one idea. And he says the very extreme of his logic would be illogical, then wanting to have only one idea, that extreme of logic would be illogical. So maybe we need multiple stories, and this is tonight's story. I'll read it again and then ask some initial questions about it. The Surangama Sutra says, when I don't see, Why don't I see the place of my not seeing? If I see my not seeing, then naturally it is not an image that is going unseen. If I do not see the realm of my not seeing, then naturally it is not a something. And then there's the strange kicker, why isn't it you? So here's some initial questions. Is this not seeing an incapacity to be overcome? When I don't see, maybe I'll get to the place where I see. What is it anyway that we are trying to see, but we don't see in this koan? Then the koan says, why isn't it you? And a first response that comes so out of the blue might be, huh? So there are a few ways to begin to ask questions about that, why isn't it you? How about, it isn't you, do you understand why it isn't? Or, you think or feel like it isn't you, why do you think or feel like that? Or, it's a rhetorical question, why isn't it you? Of course it's you, dummy. Or, it is you in a way, but that's not the one and only thing you could say about it. So Yuan Wu, in this case, and we'll come back to this later, says, helpfully or not, to say you or me is totally beside the point. And at that moment, in the midst of a metaphor that's talking about the Dharma, he shifts the metaphor, maybe. Why isn't it you? To say you or me is totally beside the point. And then also, what is it anyway? Why isn't it you? Typical Chan fashion, there's no clear antecedent for that pronoun. Why isn't what you? Okay, so that's something else to worry about. In line with what we were talking about last night, some of this may take the form of a kind of Mobius strip where we follow one thing along and it turns into something else, or we may say, well, this side is the right way to think about it, and then the opposite side turns out also to be the right way to think about it. So it's one of those twisted or looped koans that I alluded to last night. So let's back up a little bit and say a little something about seeing following case 94, the Surangama Sutra. Yuan Wu actually provides this context in his commentary. It turns out, and the backstory is kind of baroque and strange, and it's actually, I think, gynophobic and anti-sexual, because Ananda, who's the Buddha's nephew, is doing great, but he's not yet enlightened. And since he's not yet enlightened, he almost goes to bed with a courtesan, you know. And somehow the Buddha sees this and says, go rescue him, you know. And so the sutra's all about, what's the matter with my practice that I would go to bed with somebody? So that's a context that I think we could jettison helpfully. At the same time, Ananda, at this point, is trying desperately to figure out what he would do to really get awakened. And so apparently for several hundred pages, though I'm only a couple hundred pages in, they talk a lot about seeing as an analogy for something. So at one point, the Buddha says, if seeing were a thing, then you could also see my sight. If seeing were a thing, then you could also see my sight. If seeing alike were called seeing my seeing, so he already makes that a problem. Even if I'm looking at something, it's not a simple thing to say that if I see it and you see it, you see what I see. And so that's already to bring to our attention the extent to which any seeing is already an act of interpreting. It's determined by temperament, it's determined by culture, it's determined by habit. And so the very notion of seeing being a thing is already called into question in the sutra. So apparently, a few hundred pages later, we land at the part that's actually the koan. So as they say in the warrior koans, leaving all that about seeing aside for a moment, now we're back here. If seeing alike were called seeing my seeing, even if that were true, nevertheless, when I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing? So what on earth are we talking about here? One version might be that it's something that the Buddha just contingently happens to not be seeing. And that's at least an experience that we can sort of relate to. So when I don't see the refrigerator in the store that I didn't visit, why don't you not see my not seeing of the refrigerator? So that makes a little sense. If I can't see it, you can't see it either. and you can't see my not seeing it. But clearly Ananda's not worried about refrigerators. It has something to do with getting awakened. So what is it that I want to see, and why is it that I want to see what you see? So the Buddha says, how are you going to see what I don't see? If awakening is something that I can see, I can sort of show it to you, and you can sort of see what I see in sort of the same sort of way, sort of. But if I don't see it, how can I show you my not seeing, and how can you see my not seeing? To which a good answer might be, but you're the flippin' Buddha. What do you mean you don't see it? Cleary's translation, which is a little bit different, gets at something of the student-teacher relation, and I want to mention it because it's part of my experience, and I think it's, for many people, part of Zen practice. So probably have to read this twice because it's so convoluted and differently convoluted, but here's Cleary. Cleary said, and that's the classic translation of the Blue Cliff Record. Cleary says, there are two Clearys actually, Cleary and Cleary, okay. The Surangama Sutra says, when I do not see, why do you not see my not seeing? If you see my not seeing, naturally that is not the characteristic of not seeing. If you don't see my not seeing, it is naturally not a thing. How could it not be you? So if awakening or whatever it is something that the Buddha can't see and Joan can't see, how do we see what they don't see? So that won't work. So something like, I want to see what Joan sees, I want to see what that guy over there sees, how come you guys insist that you can't show it to me or pretend that you can? And so the sutra has something to do with that. Joan's translation, which is where I started, gets at least in my experience, a different facet of what it is to study Zen. So again, what she has is, when I don't see, why don't I see the place of my not seeing? So there's something that I can't see, why can't I see my own not seeing? And my experience, at least for a couple years, was that it felt contingent, like it wasn't necessary. So it was something like, I can't see what I can't see, but I can almost see what I can't see. I want so much to see it, I want so much to see what I can't see, just look harder and just burst through something. There's a moment in Moby Dick where Captain Ahab, who's whale-crazed, talks about the veneer of nature as something that you could sort of punch through, and he says it's like a pasteboard mask and you could break through it with this kind of tremendous aggression, and then you'd see what's underneath. And then he says, good Zen student that Captain Ahab was, sometimes I fear there's naught beneath, there's nothing beneath the mask, you know. But that experience of just wanting to push through it because you can almost see it. I remember especially walking around the desert a lot, and things would kind of, so I was starting to wake up in some way, things would start to shimmer for me, and it would be like, I can almost see it, this thing that I want to see, it's almost right there, but it's not quite right there. It's a little bit kind of underneath their surfaces is what it felt like. It was as if they were keeping some secret that they wouldn't quite give me, and if I could just see harder, then I'd be able to see it. Someone recently said to me in Work in the Room, and it's a similar kind of thing, I just can't quite grasp it. Something you could almost grasp, and why can't you? And that feels contingent. Like you could solve it, you know. So one of the things to say about that moment is that Zen sure is strange. There's a lot of talk in the tradition about gouging a wound in perfectly good flesh. The teachings tend to do that. So, you know, I was fine, I was a happy guy, and then this Zen thing got to me, and all these weird things that weren't problems started kind of gnawing at me. So it's a very strange thing just to be a middle-aged guy walking around the desert looking at creosote bushes and saying, I can almost see it, but I can't quite, and it's making me crazy, you know. I think the wager of the tradition is that when that happens, that there's a kind of dissatisfaction and discontent that you already experienced anyway in your life in one way or another, and it's kind of condensed and thrown onto that, the same way Joan says, you can throw everything into working with no. Anything that's a problem for you, just throw it into no and concentrate it on that. So, what about not seeing as a model for Zen practice? Well, let's talk a little bit more about the problems of seeing it or trying to see it as a model for Zen practice. And this will recap in some ways some of the stuff I was saying last night, but in a slightly different form. So there's a now dead critic named Walter Ong, which if you're fond of trivia, he was actually Marshall McLuhan, the media guy. He was a Jesuit priest and academic who was Marshall McLuhan's teacher. And he gets really interested in the different senses and the way different cultures kind of give prominence to one particular sense. And some of this, I think, is a little romanticized, but there's some truth in it, and it overlaps with the Zen tradition in important ways. So one of the things he says, and I think I said this last night, is that of all the senses, sight really seems to be the one that most sets things over against us. That there's less of a sense, I think, of sort of things coming in at the eye than the eye seeing things that are over there. And again, the romanticized part, maybe, though I think there's some truth in this, is Ong says that, for example, hearing doesn't really work like that, that there's a sense of the sound sort of coming right into us, and that hearing sort of brings things inside us, is how we feel about it, or makes them closer. And I think you could say the same thing about smell, or the same thing about touch. When you touch something, you feel its difference, but you have an intimate kind of contact with it. And then extrapolating from that, and I think it's important for us in some way, Ong suggests that once you're inside primarily a print culture, you're in a culture that's really going to value seeing and the visual. That once you're in a culture that instead of sitting around the fire and listening to stories like this, though I'm reading some of what I'm saying, so it's a little complicated, but once you're in basically a print culture, there's that tendency to really begin to distance yourself from the immediacy of things. So if that's true, and I'll try to do this quickly, but visual or print culture in some way then doubles down on what we already said about being in language. And so the what's wrong with seeing has something to do with some of the difficulties I noted last night. And so again, maybe the most important is that once we're in language and once we're in visual culture and seeing, that sense of I as the knower over against the objects that I know creates this very, very fundamental separation. And it's also true, and I know we don't think this all the time and absolutely, but to the extent that I'm the knower and the namer, I'm really not part of the field. There's a great book by David Hinton called Hunger Mountain that's really all about this and the way that as culture develops in certain directions, that sense of the I as both the seeing I and the self as exempt from the field that it sees is a kind of habit of mind and person and behavior that is fairly inescapable. And then as we mentioned last time, there's always the problem of categorizing and binarizing and throwing things into different groups. The 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant talked about phenomena, and that, but what he meant by that was things as we see them through our sensorium. And his claim was already that given the human sensorium, it's a kind of odd problem, but the claim was that what we see is the object of our perceptions, which isn't the same as what's really out there. You know, so already there's some gap or distance between us and the real, as it were. And then Wittgenstein, the 20th century language philosopher, says that all seeing is a seeing as. Right, so once we're in language, like if I said, see the altar, but now close your eyes and see it, and now keep seeing it, but don't see it as an altar anymore, just see it, that's pretty hard to do. That we're already in those categories and those groupings, and that in some way, we're not seeing things exactly as they are. I think maybe this is especially true of Western Zen, but I kind of doubt it. But given that sort of philosophical predicament, one version of Zen meditation, I think, and it's one that I've been involved in myself certainly sometimes, is that Ahab thing about punching through the pasteboard mask. And so there's a version of meditation which involves this kind of desperately intense attempt to really see. You know, this kind of wall-eyed stare toward the world as if you could burst through all the categories and all your ideas about things and just see the real thing. You know, I'll finally see the thing in itself. Okay. Kant's name for that was noumena, the things as they actually are. And he said, well, you can't see them, but then Zen students come along and say, watch me, I'm going to do it. Okay. Dale Wright, who's an important philosopher of the Zen tradition, says that traditionally, there's within the Chan and Zen traditions, there's a lot of sort of philosophically romantic talk about Zen that talks about it in exactly those terms, that, you know, the veils will fall away, you'll no longer see through your categories, you will just see reality exactly as it is. And that's one whole version of what a Zen practice would be, and a kind of intense practice might have something like that involved in it. And I think there's probably some utility in this intensity, but there are a couple things to say about it. One thing is that it's kind of aggressive. It's as if, you know, there I was out there trying to see the real creosote. It's almost as if with my eyes, if I just wring its neck hard enough, it'll give up its secret. You know, I'll finally see right through whatever it is that's blocking me, and the object will give up all its intimate secrets if I just push on it hard enough. Okay, and this kind of super seeing, you know, can lead exactly to that sense of I'm over against it until I make it give up its secret. So in some way, you're really doubling down on the sense that you're over here and everything else is over there, and you're trying to conquer it or master it. And that's probably not a good practice. I remember one retreat where a lot of us were talking in a discussion one afternoon or evening with Joan about something like that. And she said, you know, it's kind of interesting that everybody has this view of practice as, you know, you have to go through 8 years of beating your head against a wall, and then finally something will happen. And she said, maybe you could just not beat your head against a wall. You could try something different. And it was interesting. The discussion was not completely gendered, but it was somewhat gendered. So all the guys, with some humor, sort of said, I know there's no point in it, and I know it won't work, but it's been immensely valuable to me to beat my head against a wall for 8 years, even though I know it won't work. Okay. So one version of that, maybe, and maybe this is what we were saying, is that if you just do it long enough, eventually you're going to exhaust yourself. Your head's going to hurt. You're going to be tired of beating your head against the wall for 8 years. And in that moment of exhaustion, finally, you can allow something else to happen. Another version of it, which I kind of like, is that you lean in and lean in, trying to really see the thing and really see the thing. And if you lean just far enough, you'll actually topple over, and then you'll fall in. And that might be a sort of byproduct of trying so hard to strain to really see with Zen intensity. But Joan's suggestion, I think, is a good one, and it's maybe you can just stop trying to do that and see what happens. Okay. And so now, you know, we're back in that realm of not seeing. So what if you adopted as your provisional metaphor for the retreat that what's going on is that you're not going to see it because it isn't something you can see. In fact, it's not an it, it's not an object at all set over against you. Hakuin, who's really fierce, the 18th century Japanese great koan teacher, but had an odd sense of humor and could be strangely waggish, says this in his commentary about the koan. And I think the detail to which he goes into just a couple things is where the humor is. He says, all things can be seen by the eyes, but not seeing is not a thing. It's not a green thing. It's not a red thing. And then he says, the realm that is not a thing, here it gets strange, is your true vision. True vision is your essential nature. So that's really strange, because in the midst of a koan about not seeing, he talks about your essential vision. But I think he's doing that on purpose, and I think the idea is there's a sense of the visionary, which is not something you see. So he's mixing his metaphors, maybe. And this is a digression, but it's a quick one, and it's such a strange moment that I have to do this. So do you remember I said earlier that Yuan Wu, in his commentary to the case, as the kind of run-up to talking about not seeing, says, oh, here's Ananda and the Buddha talking about when I see something, what happens to your seeing. And Yuan Wu kind of wags his finger at Shuido, who's the one who put together the Blue Cliff record, and then Yuan Wu is writing the commentary, and he loves Shuido, but he's tweaking him. So he says, Shuido here does not quote the entire passage. Like, he doesn't give the run-up about seeing, so it's confusing. Shuido here does not quote the entire passage of the scripture. And then he says, and I love this, if it is quoted in full, then it can be seen. Which is really nutty, you know, so it's a little joke about, you know, I can make you see what the not seeing. So in a more serious vein, here's Dale Wright again, the philosopher of Zen and Chan. And he's talking specifically, it's a book he wrote about transmission of mind, Wangbo's Dharma Talk, but it bears directly on this. So he says, a significant proportion of Wangbo's Dharma Talk is concerned with correcting the conception of that which is experienced in enlightenment. This is the conception of mind or Buddha, or I would add of it to fit it in with the case we're reading. This is the conception of mind or Buddha or it, still conceived dualistically as something to which the practitioner must come to be related. So it's over against you. Turning away from ordinary things in the world, the source, this is the wrong-headed sense of practice that Wangbo is trying to correct. Turning away from ordinary things in the world, the source is sought as something extraordinary, but still something. One being among many, even if more mysterious, more powerful, and so on. So seeing the source would be seeing a thing. Taking one rhetorical pose after another, Wangbo's text asserts that the source is not anything at all, but rather that within which all things are encountered. I would want to go that one better and get rid of encountered, because as soon as you say that within which all things are encountered, you still have that subject-object relation. So maybe that within which all things are, including the encounterer, who also falls in, and then that encounter of subject with object takes place in a field where subject and object are not really the appropriate terms anymore, since it's not really clear that one thing stands over against another anymore. Another way to say it, maybe, is that everything is held in it. And at that point, it even feels like the wrong thing to say, because you tend to turn it into an object. But as T.S. Eliot says, I got to use words when I talk to you. Okay. Here's something else that feels appropriate to say about this moment, though it's a little bit difficult for me to explain why. Norman Fisher, in one of his talks, is reading from a posthumous book by Katagiri, who's one of Suzuki Roshi's disciples. And there's a very beautiful thing where Katagiri says, impermanence makes us very quiet. Impermanence makes us very quiet. And maybe in that moment where everything is held in the it that's not an it, there's a sense that everything that's held, including ourselves, is contingent and fleeting and in play, and yet at the same time it's held in this limitless stillness. So one of the senses in that moment is the very tender impermanence makes us very quiet. So if you're interested in not seeing as a possible model or metaphor for a couple days, what are some things that we can suggest about it? What are some of the pragmatics of it, among other things? So here's a minor point that I don't want to make too serious, but given what Ong said about visuality, what would happen if you fell into hearing and smelling and touching, or touching at a distance with your imagination, where you see something moving and you feel what it might be like to move, or you see a tree trunk and you have some sense of what it would feel like to run your hand against it? That's not to say, oh, you can't see it, but you can hear it. Oh, you can't see it, but you can touch it. But it is to say that as we begin to kind of scramble up seeing, and we begin to do that kind of mingling of the senses that I talked about last time, which the Zen tradition says has to do with being more intimate with things, that in some Mobius strip-like kind of way, that sense of there's this thing over against us that we've got to master and we've got to see may begin to dissipate. And the double-sided thing about the Mobius strip may begin to come forward, that you're not too sure which is on which side of the strip anymore. So what are some other ways of hanging around with the sense, or waiting for something to happen, and what it might be like when it happens? So here's some other little stories. You discover yourself inside of something you didn't know you were inside of, something that you thought was set over against you. You discover that something is always already supporting you, though maybe you weren't usually aware of this support. You sense that one kind of appropriate way to wait for this thing to happen is what Wordsworth called wise passiveness, and more simply we could call receptivity. You can't make it happen. You can't force it. The wonderful Australian Zen teacher and filmmaker Susan Murphy told a story once about a white woman going out into the back with some Aboriginal people, and they were going to a really special spot that was kind of numinous in a way. And it was almost like she was tapping her foot and looking at her watch, you know, well, when's this being going to show up already? You know? And they just said, you can't do that, you know. So Suzuki Roshi says, I have learned to wait. And it's almost as if you're not waiting for anything in that moment. Just, I've learned to wait. So learning to wait would be part of this vision of not seeing. Another story that Joan likes to tell is that maybe something fetches you. Maybe something just comes and pulls you into the field and you fall into it. And then it's really like not to. Another thing that might happen, and it might happen right after that or it might happen before it, is that all of a sudden, as we're told in the Blue Cliff Record case 22, it's as if, not as if, it, you feel that the teachings flow out of your own breast. So the moment where something comes to fetch you may also be the moment where you flow forward toward it. And in that moment, why isn't it you? Well, here's another turn. Yuanwu says, to say you or me is totally beside the point. So I think partly that's about the notion that everything is held in and by and as that place or non-place and as that thing or non-thing. So partly maybe he's saying it's not just you, or another way to put it is it's not you as just you. That everything circulates, the gift has to circulate, emptiness has something to do with being empty of own being, and everything is interpermeated. So at that moment, to say you or me is totally beside the point. And yet and still from another point of view, why isn't it you? The source of the bright is clear and unstained, and that comes right up through you and flows through your own breast. Here's another turn. Why isn't it you? What it are we talking about anyway? So maybe in this place where why isn't it you is about the place from which everything comes and within which everything is held, we can also say that why isn't it you also means that everything you see is you. So why isn't it you? Why isn't the vastness you? But, you know, you're looking at the creosote. Why isn't it you? And Tenkai, another great Japanese teacher, says in his commentary on the case, of all the myriad things, none is not you. So in a funny way, it's as if that sort of secret of the object that I was going for, what's that thing that I can't see about the creosote? It's in that moment of not seeing. And in that moment, the thing I couldn't see about the creosote is exactly how it's no different from me. And that's the secret in some way, or that's one name for the secret. At the same time, to turn it again, here's Miyazong, a 12th century woman Chan teacher. And I'm going to be really a bad boy and rephrase what she said, which is really chutzpah, you know. But she says, each being's eternal radiance appears before you. So in the context of this going, appears before you doesn't quite feel right. So each being's eternal radiance shines through you. And then she says, each being is an 800-foot precipice. You know, so there's that place where I don't see the creosote and where the creosote is no different from me and where its eternal radiance shines through and as me. And at the same time, I should have picked a fishhook barrel cactus. At the same time, it's a fishhook barrel cactus. It's an 8,000-foot precipice and yowie, look out. You know, so as Shito says, everything we perceive is interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving goes on and on, while each thing stands in its own place. And that thing of each thing standing in its own place is the Tathagata quality of things. And another paradox that is one of those Mobius strip things, I think, or qualities, is that strangely enough, in the moment where the interweaving becomes more palpable, where the why isn't it you becomes more palpable, the Tathagata also becomes more powerful and palpable. Womp, there it is, over against you. And look at it, it'll bite you. If you're not careful, that both those things are true in and as the same moment sometimes. Here's another paradox. On the one hand, it isn't something you see, and yet it's still true in that moment, as Tori Zenji says, that things can't help but shine with this light. So it isn't something you see, but in the moment you fall into that, everything gets radiant. As a kind of, I don't know, it's a bonus card, something like that. And in some way, because of this not seeing and through this not seeing, you see things differently. And the other part of that paradox is that they seem to see you differently as well. That's part of that moment also. So what are a couple other things quickly to say about how to get there and what the result might be like? One thing to stress is the spirit of generosity. So if we want to be fetchable, as Joan says, we have to be available, have a kind of warm curiosity. The poet Keats talks about the greeting of the spirit. So we have to meet reality with a sort of openness, with an open heart and an open spirit, if it's going to meet us. And in that moment, again, the subject and object maybe falls away and we're both held in this vastness. And then also, along with Wordsworth's wise passiveness, there's Keats's negative capability. He says, the ability to remain in the midst of doubts and mysteries without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. And our version of that is not knowing is most intimate. So that's another way to sit with this koan and this sutra. Hakuin says, also commenting on this case, when it comes to this great matter, even in the great congregation on Spiritual Mountain, nobody can know. Okay, so why can't you see my not seeing? The way has nothing to do with knowing or not knowing. And then wonderfully, everybody tweaks everybody in the Zen tradition. So we tweak Shwedo and then says, I don't think it's really a tweak. He says, Shwedo sets it forth with open eyes, quote, there is nothing but naming and describing rumor and gossip, right? So in this moment where there's no knowing, nevertheless, teachers are endlessly involved in naming and describing rumor and gossip to try to make it palpable for other people. And I think Hakuin loves that, and he thinks that Shwedo's doing it knowingly. The last thing I want to say is about the other koans that I hope we'll get to. We'll get to at least one of them Saturday night, maybe two of them. I think that this place that I've been talking about, which is the place of why isn't it you, but is also the place where to say you or I is totally beside the point, is also important and an important part of those other two koans. In the two chens, it probably has something to do with an understanding of how we might see and inhabit our own lives. And in the Laman Pang koan about falling down, it has something to do with how we might be with others and how we might be of help to others, even in a dark time. But for now, I just want to say, please enjoy your not seeing. Thank you. So we have a few minutes for conversation, if we'd like to have that.
I just thought the beginning of it, the first sentence.
Of the koan?
Of the koan.
Yeah. When I don't see, why don't I see the place of my not seeing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to like almost negate the whole on, because you're saying when I don't see, well, how could you see if you don't see? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a pretty long con, starting from that point.
There's a thing in Wittgenstein where he talks about, so it's a tautology in a way, right? If I don't see, why don't I see? And Wittgenstein talks about deep tautologies. And he says there are these formulations in philosophy which actually are tautological, but they're actually getting at something really deep and really important through that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that came to me, I'm not going to remember the, I think it's when we were talking about the Kriya Soap. the secret that linking to the koan about there's nothing, I'm keeping nothing hidden from you as the teacher.
Oh yeah.
As another place where you're grasping something.
Yeah. I can't, somebody will probably remember who this is, but there's another one where, maybe Dogen, I'm not sure, but from, maybe it's from the refuge ceremony. From the beginning, nothing has ever been hidden. Is that in the refuge? But that's related to that, yeah. There's another koan that I love, that for me is related to that, which is hide in a pillar from the Asekyasin gates. I shouldn't say this, but one of my reactions to that was, no, you go hide in a pillar.
And while you're at it, go pee on the roof.
Yeah. So that thing about things feeling hidden, it's strange because it's a little bit like first things are mountains and then they're but backwards. You know, it didn't used to be a problem. It wasn't like anything was hidden. But then it seemed like everything was hiding behind itself or inside itself. And then there's this moment, it's like everything is just wearing it right on its face and on its surface. You know, that everything you see feels like it sees you and is full of the same radiance that you're feeling, you know. So, on Thursdays, anyway.
For me, that koan, it reminds me of the, you know, the Russian eggs, you know, the...
That's, I mean, for me, that's, you know, maybe it's a guy thing I was saying, but in a way that's a good metaphor for years of practice for me.
Yes.
You know, it's only 11 more eggs to go. Yeah.
Bill, the 10 egg hurting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, one of the things that came to me when you were talking about the Moby Dick thing and trying to break through and beating your head against the wall. It brought to mind this, what I originally heard is Gary Snyder saying something about that meditation was a lot like trying to hold an avocado seed. You know, if you held it too tight, it squirted away. And recently I was looking at a poetry book, and I'm not sure that he actually said, there's actual poem called Avocado, and maybe that's in it. But I do think that that's right, that it's a little, you know, like trying to see that creosote too hard, it squirts right away.
Yeah, that's right. And maybe there's a bunch of people who meditated for 10 years and it was never like that for them. I don't know. Thus have I heard, you know.
Well, I can't say anything about, you know, I don't have any thoughts of my own about what you've talked about, but what I do feel like is now I've been in this pool of the koan a little bit better. I mean, even just the why isn't it you, which came out of nowhere and meant nothing to me, you know, I have a sense of it, have a sense of something from what you've said, is what I'm just trying to say, that, you know, I just,
great.
There, you know, you created a pool for me to jump in.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
I'll second that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the context of it does help a little bit. That, you know, the Buddha's talking to Ananda, and I think that whole context in the beginning helps a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I never sat a whole retreat with this koan in mind, you know, but it would be a strange project in a way. It's a little bit. It's not the same thing, but it's a little bit like John Terence. Quick, don't get ready.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you're sitting there not trying to see something you can't see, there's a kind of urgent project that you might have thought you had that falls away. And what remains after that falls away or when it falls away is a little mysterious, I think. You know? But yeah, I mean, so the why isn't it you, I think, is an attempt by the koan to kind of gesture at
so
what it might be like when the project falls away.
So You're saying like it leaves like a vacuum?
Yeah, I mean, so if I say my project is there's this thing that's really hard to see, but I'm determined that this is the retreat that I'm going to see it. I mean, that's sort of a crazy project, but at least it's a project, mm-hmm. and you can work yourself up to be intense about it. But if you say, well, actually, there isn't something that you're going to see, that's not it. It's a little harder to figure out what the project is. And what I'm suggesting is the project has something to do with that sort of wise passiveness, or the greeting of the spirit, or being fetchable, or warm curiosity, as Joan talks about it. You know, that you're waiting for something that you can't really force your way through. And, you know, Joan used to talk about the gendered quality of kind of standard Zen metaphors and the whole thing about, you know, bursting through the barrier. I mean, it's certainly a male kind of image. And she used to say that, you know, a notion of receptivity, which she associated in some way as feminine, felt more useful. And I would say that pretty much all my experiences where I felt something shifted felt mostly like moments of receptivity rather than moments of sort of the heroic quester knight bursting through the barrier, you know.
Why I don't think that the not seeing doesn't seem to me to be an incapacity.
Yeah.
Because it's if you, and why the first part of the calling made sort of sense right away, because it's kind of that idea of knowing what you don't know. I mean, if you don't see that you're not seeing, then you're really not seeing. But if you see that you're not seeing, then it's okay because you can just wait.
That's great, yeah. That reminds me of something else Joan used to say about when you said the thing about knowing what you don't know, is she said people come to Zen wanting to experience something they've never experienced, but they have this really doggedly determined idea that in some way they know what it is that they're going to experience. You know, yeah, so that's exactly, yeah, that's great, thank you.
Well, I think I don't have all the connections, but I think that it does intrigue me, this sense of falling in with the pain, with that poem too, that I'm helping as I fall with you.
Oh yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and
yeah,
and that as a as an action.
Oh yeah, that's great.
As something different than punching through, you're falling with and in.
That's great.
And then it's fortunately, or
yeah,
luckily nobody's looking.
Yeah.
Or luckily nobody's looking. So then it's like, huh? So who sees there? Who's who's not looking?
Yeah.
Is it me that's not looking? Is it
observers
about me helping in a certain way? Is it?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I never thought about the. I mean, I always read it as, literally, I guess the falling's unfortunate, you know, so it's a commiseration, but to say, oh, falling is great, let me join you in your falling is really wonderful, too.
Like Lehman Bain and his daughter?
Yeah.
I thought that koan has recently come to me because of my father, and it came to me in this flash that he's aging, his memory is very limited, but he's more present than he has ever been in my entire life, which is actually an incredible gift. So we have these conversations we would never have, and sometimes the only thing I can do is truly fall with him.
Yeah.
As soon as I reach to do anything, first of all, he's furious. Understandably, and it finally occurred to me, it was like I could hear him saying, well, luckily nobody sees you helping me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you're the one who's going to help me and I want you to be here, but no, I don't want anybody to see you doing this, because, and that's the tension in it, a dance. Kind
of. Yeah, thank you.
But the intimacy comes in the falling, it doesn't come in the helping, in the way that I My first sentence.
Yeah. There. One of the times Joan talked about the koan, she said there was a retreat at St. Dorothy's where there was a guy who had some kind of medical condition, and they were doing a walking meditation, and he fell down, and the person behind him just fell with him. The same. And yes, that's right. That's prior to helping at all. It's just falling.
The falling does seem, the only way I can fall is to say I don't know.
Yeah.
Because if I think I know, then I won't.
Yeah.
I won't fall.
Oh yeah.
So there's this. I think that might connect to seeing.
Yeah. Seems to have something to do with bracing or not bracing, mm-hmm. right? Bracing yourself or not bracing yourself. It's just falling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's pretty much time to close the hall, right? In about 2 minutes. So, do we want to walk first for a minute? Did everybody like to stretch their legs before we close the hall, or not? Mm-hmm. You're the head of practice, you decide. Should we walk for a minute or not?
Okay.
Thank you.